Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. 21,000 factory workers are about to lose their jobs. 2,400 dealerships are about to close. 9 plants will shut down, all in an attempt to salvage a version of what was once the biggest employer in the United States, General Motors. President Barack Obama announced today that the government will invest a total of $50 billion in GM in exchange for 60% ownership of the company.
Working with my auto task force, GM and its stakeholders have produced a viable, achievable plan that will give this iconic American company a chance to rise again. It's a plan tailored to the realities of today's auto market, a plan that positions GM to move toward profitability, even if it takes longer than expected for our economy to fully recover.
The other owners of the new GM will be the United Auto Workers, bondholders, essentially investors in GM, and the Canadian government. We're going to hear from a host of people across the country today. Let's start with Paul Eisenstein, publisher of the DetroitBureau.com. And Paul, we've been hearing about factory closings this morning. Just outline for us, how will this 90-day or more bankruptcy proceeding work? Will we continue to hear about closings and pairings away? And will GM be operating during the bankruptcy?
At the moment, we're waiting right now to hear more from Fritz Henderson, who is the GM CEO. We may have some more details from that. But it appears that the plan that they've laid out right now will stand, at least through the bankruptcy proceedings. And in fact, if we do hear significant more cuts being announced afterwards, it means that they made a mistake in the bankruptcy, the turnaround plan that they've pulled together over these last few months isn't good enough, and that would not be a very good sign.
Yeah, so if we hear more factories being shuttered, and we're going to speak to someone in a town where they just learned today they're losing a factory, but if we hear more, it's not going well.
No, that would probably be a sign that it is not going well. The real question is how long it will take GM, first of all, to get through the bankruptcy, but more importantly in many ways, is how long it will take for the American public to reevaluate what GM is doing and decide whether or not they believe in GM. And that will affect ultimately what happens, because we have seen over the last 6 months that the public has been very, very nervous about buying cars from both GM and Chrysler. People are worried. Do I want to buy a car from a company that could go bankrupt? The administration helped when in March they announced this new warranty guarantee program, which said even if the companies did go away, we would cover your warranties. And that seems to have begun to do a bit of a turnaround.
Right.
The president just minutes ago said he noted that preliminary numbers show that Chrysler sales were up last month. And I just posted on my site a report a few hours ago that indicates that people who weren't ready to buy GM products a few months ago, now maybe.
Right. Chrysler ahead of GM in the process, already in bankruptcy proceedings. And the president said consumers have no need to worry. Well, Paul Eisenstein, I want you to stand by there for just 1 second. As we mentioned, 9 GM plants are closing. They include plants in Livonia, Flint, and Ypsilanti Township in Michigan, Parma, Ohio, Fredericksburg, Virginia. In Ontario, Ohio, a parts stamping plant is slated to close next year. David Metzgers retired from that plant in April. He's now the town city council president, and we just want to get his thoughts on this. David, your thoughts on hearing that the plant is closing there.
It's devastating. It's something that we've been hearing could have been a possibility for the last couple of years, and it's just today it finally came to pass.
Well, what did you do at the plant, by the way, when you worked there?
I worked in the welder maintenance department, metal assembly side of the plant. One side of the plant assembled components that shipped out that went to other plants to build cars, and then one side of the plant was the stamping facility that stamped out the parts that went to other plants to build a car.
And what kind of role, I know your dad, your late dad, also worked there for 30 years, so this is generations have worked in the plant. What other impact did it have on the town?
Well, the plant built the town. I mean, obviously, when you have a facility that large and that many people working, they need a lot of things. Stores to buy anything from clothes, groceries, the restaurants for folks to go out and eat in. Just everything just builds up all the way around a new facility like that, and especially when it employs that many people and a decent pay scale.
Are you worried about what happens to a town if these, well, there's now 1,200 people, I think, at the factory. If these people need to move and go elsewhere for work, what happens to schools and things like that?
That's going to be a major impact, and that's something that I'm sure the school system's been looking at. We've been trying to look at it, too. With the way the economy's been and all the foreclosures, obviously people can't pay their taxes, and it's going to affect them also.
Does it help at all to know that what's happening today, including the plant and your town closing, is hopefully going to save GM?
Oh, yes, definitely, because... You know, we're just obviously we're just a small part of the big picture, and if we would have lost that corporation, we'd have put all those folks out of work. And that's what a lot of people don't understand, and you read it every now and then. But the people that supply all the extra parts that go in the car, the tires, the paint, the nuts and bolts, those folks are going to be all directly affected. Then the folks in the grocery stores, the school systems, the clothing stores, department stores, restaurants, everyone could and will be affected by that.
Well, that's very generous of you, David Metzger. David is the city council president in Ontario, Ohio. He's also a former worker at the GM plant there. They've just learned today that that plant will be closed, but as he just said, it's an attempt to try to save GM. David, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Okay, let's go back to Paul Eisenstein, publisher of the DetroitBureau.com. Paul, that surprised me a little bit, you know, that he was so generous, almost saying we had to sacrifice in our town to save GM. But, you know, are Americans going to feel that way? You were talking about how Americans are wary of buying cars from companies that are in reorganization. And we understand the success of a new GM is based on an idea that the company will sell 10 million cars a year. This at a time when people aren't buying new cars, period.
No, not that they will sell 10 million, that the industry will get back to 10 million, and that they will sell approximately 20%. That is their target, to be able to break even at roughly 20% in a 10 million car market.
Okay, even then though, is that what do you think the possibilities are?
That's a difficult one. If GM, in fact, cannot reconnect with a lot of consumers on both coasts where they have weakened year after year after year, it will be extremely difficult, especially when you consider they are dropping Hummer, Saturn, Pontiac, and Saab. So, you know, they're losing a bunch of operations. They actually have to gain market share to make this work with their core brands, Chevrolet, Cadillac, Buick and GMC, and that will not be easy. On the other hand, the idea that they are at the point where they could make a profit at just 10 in a market of 10.5 million is phenomenal. This is a company that was essentially losing money in the best years that the American auto market ever saw early in this decade. Flat, flaccid, bloated. It was just a disaster waiting to happen.
Yeah.
And this could put them on a par with the best of the imports. Now, here's where we should see some hope. GM has been scoring well in a number of areas. Their quality has been going up. Buick just knocked Lexus out of the top spot in J.D. Power's vehicle dependability survey. Nobody thought that was possible. GM's productivity is, according to some of the toughest measurements, coming up on Toyota. And Chrysler, by the way, actually matched Toyota last year in the Harbor Report, which everybody takes as the final word on productivity. And on and on and on. I'm on the North American Car of the Year jury. 50 journalists from across North America actually gave GM, their Chevy Malibu, the top pick last year as the best car in North America. So GM is making a lot of moves. The biggest challenge they have is getting Americans to believe it.
Right. At a time when we're hearing that, you know, I just mentioned in passing, Americans are maybe moving away from a culture that like to buy new cars because of the recession. Well, just briefly want you to touch on the workers. The UAW is going to need to finance about half of its $20 billion health care fund with this depleted stock from new GM. And we understand that the pension fund is underfunded by $12 to $13 billion.
Yes.
It looks like a mess on the horizon there.
Well, the UAW has got to be very, very worried because they were in the proverbial position of being between that rock and hard place. They could have tried to resist, and they would have seen GM go down. They never would have gotten any money. So they had to take a much smaller amount of cash and a lot of stock based on an if-come situation. Can GM rebuild itself and, say, in 2 years, will they be able to cash out of at least some of that stock, enough of the stock, to be able to come up with the billions that they need to get this VEBA, the employee health care program, funded? If not, well, guess who's going to be paying for that, too?
Taxpayer. Paul Eisenstein, publisher of the DetroitBureau.com. Paul, thanks so much, and I'm sure over the next 90 days of this bankruptcy proceeding, we'll be talking to you again. Thank you.
Good. Good to talk with you.
Well, as we've said, General Motors will be closing 2,400 dealerships nationwide, 40% of their total. GM hasn't gone public with the list of closings, but they did notify the dealerships privately by letter. One of those dealerships, Poulin Auto Country in Rochester, New Hampshire, and joining us, Ron Poulin. He owns Poulin Auto Country along with his brother and father. They bought the dealership 3 years ago. Ron, you got one of those letters, didn't you?
Yeah, we got one of the letters, and with all the press going, we felt that it was important for us to let our customers and our employees know where we stood and that we were in jeopardy.
And are you going to appeal that? Because as we understand it, GM gave dealerships the opportunity to appeal the closings.
Yes, the appeal date, or I believe the deadline for the date, was last Friday, and we sent an appeal and they have received it because they did acknowledge it.
We understand the way the franchises work is that GM sells you the cars to the dealerships. They don't take care of the payroll, right? You do. But,
that's right.
But GM maintains and pays for oversight of the dealerships and coordinating the inventory. And they're saying they're going to close 2,400 shops because I guess that's going to save them a lot of money in whatever they're doing to, you know, pay for the oversight. What are your thoughts? How would you defend dealership? What will you say to defend against the closing?
Well, it's all our capital that's involved in it. It's not GM's capital that's involved in the dealership. We buy the products from General Motors, whether it be new car inventory or parts inventory. We buy that stuff. We're the ones that maintain the payroll with our employees. We don't receive any money from General Motors as it relates to that.
I know you have a Chrysler dealership as well, and that you got a letter from them saying that is going to stay open, so at least you have that. But what would you want to say to Americans? Because what we're hearing is that Americans have to start buying these cars for this to work.
Yeah.
Make your pitch.
well, the pitch is that, you know, whether it's Poulin Auto Country or other dealers, there are a lot of non-manufacturers' jobs being lost at the dealership level. And the dealers are not an expense to the manufacturer, as a matter of fact, where their asset and where their outlet. And I know it's a tough perception to overcome, but the automakers that are still here, Chrysler and GM, make some great, great products.
Ron Poulin, co-owner of Poulin Auto Country in Rochester, New Hampshire, appealing to General Motors the closing of their dealership. Ron, best of luck to you.
Thank you very much.
Okay, just ahead, what happened? GM was a trendsetter. The first fins on cars were on GM's Cadillac. We'll take a look at the storied history in 1 minute, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back.
The GM5, a 58th great direct by General Motors, Chevrolet.
In this 1958 commercial, we see women in flowing ball gowns on the floor of a GM dealership showcasing the GM5. The commercial says they're the best that you'll drive. They also had the first fins on a car. That was on a Cadillac in 1948. In 1979, GM was the biggest private employer in the U.S. GM was the first automaker to unionize after violent strikes in Flint, Michigan in 1937. Through the 1950s, GM sold more than half of the cars in the U.S. And Detroit was as bright and shiny as the Silicon Valley is today. Marianne Keller, an independent auto industry analyst and author of Rude Awakening, The Rise, Fall, and Struggle of General Motors, and also author of Collision, GM, Toyota, Volkswagen, and the Race to Own the 21st Century, joins us for a look at that storied history. Marianne, you say that under the leadership of Alfred Sloan, he took over in 1929, GM gave Americans aspirational consumption. What was that?
Well, Alfred Sloan was able to bring order from the chaos of the acquisitions that Billy Durant had made when he cobbled together General Motors from a bunch of emerging automakers. So Buick and Pontiac were all, and Chevrolet were all acquisitions that he put together, and Alfred Sloan then decided what each of them should represent to the consumer, with Chevrolet being the basic entry-level car and Cadillac obviously being the car that you aspired to own and becoming also the symbol of great wealth. I remember when I was a child, the Buick was kind of, and I'm an old lady by this time, so when you hear this, you'll know, the Buick was the car sort of driven by the doctor who had his little black bag making house calls. It was the car that was a little bit understated when you didn't want to be so showy, but you also wanted to indicate to people that you've arrived. So each car, each brand had its place in the market, right, and you could tell kind of from the nature of the neighborhood the kind of car that's likely to be in the driveway.
Well, it also, Mickey Maynard reminds us today in the New York Times, helped create the middle class. Hundreds of thousands of car workers sort of lifted up into the middle class. What else did the company come to symbolize in its halcyon days?
Well, I think it's, you know, did the company do that, or did the fact that we all wanted to drive cars do that?
Right, right, you know, and the company knew that, right.
Yeah, I mean, you know, General Motors did a lot of innovative things that enabled people to buy cars. General Motors was the first company, for example, to develop a finance operation. That was also something that Alfred Sloan did, because they recognized that the majority of people could not afford to write a check or walk into a dealership with cash in those days to pay for a car. So buying a car on time became one of GM's innovations. So, yes, indeed, they did help to put transportation in more families' driveways over the years.
They also had quite a few potholes along the way. I'm remembering that in the 60s we had congressional auto safety hearings because Ralph Nader took on the Corvair, the GM car that was supposed to be the answer to the small European cars. But what do you think, in essence, is the second half of the story? Why did GM fail?
You know, the first half of GM's story is credited to Alfred Sloan and his finance wizard, who was named Donaldson Brown. And those two men created the organizational structure, the product rationale, and the financial discipline that allowed General Motors to become such a dominant force in the market that by the 1960s the government was holding hearings about whether or not General Motors had gotten too big and should be broken up. I think in the 1960s, they were so swollen and so arrogant with their success that they failed to realize that the world was changing and they could no longer dictate. And I think that is something that GM management almost till this day has forgotten, in spite of the fact that they've lost half of their market.
Well, we've done interviews here on this program, and again with people like Mickey Maynard, who follow the industry, and yourself, and we've asked. I can remember just a few years ago asking, doesn't GM see that the American people are turning to smaller cars? And the answer was no. I mean, they just didn't see it. Is it also because of who they now had on their boards?
Well, I think it was a combination of things. First of all, as long as gasoline was cheap, they could make a lot of money on trucks, and they would not make any money on small cars. So there certainly was a financial logic to their complaints. And let's face it, the American public really is fickle. If gasoline's $5 a gallon, we'll buy small cars. If gasoline's $2 a gallon, we go right back to our SUVs. You can't blame them for that. The issue of management, however, and management blindness to the world around it, whether it was the consumers or the fact that they didn't respect their competition and didn't understand the source of competitive advantage that their competition had, that they thought Japanese workers were just sort of human robots, and that was an advantage as opposed to understanding how they created quality and efficiency and continuous improvement. That was all part and parcel of this incredible blindness that they suffered from. I blame management, and I blame the board of directors for getting General Motors to the point where in 2009 the company had to file for bankruptcy today. The board of directors is responsible for hiring and firing the CEO. I, in my 30 years on Wall Street, never saw any evidence, with the exception of one time in 1992, when the board actually acted to get rid of a CEO who was clearly running the company into the ground and almost had GM in bankruptcy that year. But well, that was the only time they acted.
Well, the Obama administration has asked for 6 out of 12 GM directors to be replaced. That's independent auto industry analyst Marianne Keller, also author of Rude Awakening, The Rise, Fall, and Struggle of General Motors. Marianne, this is a process that's going to be taking a long time. We hope to have you back to talk about your observations of this company you've taken such a close look at. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, just shifting gears a bit, no pun intended. Tomorrow on Here and Now, actor John Krasinski takes a break from The Office to talk about his new film. And again, we'll continue to follow the story of GM as it unfolds over the next several days. Still ahead today, we go to the Time Dollar Youth Court in Washington, D.C. Back after the latest news, Here and Now. The fate of that missing Air France plane and the 228 people on board is still unknown. A search is on, but the French transportation minister says there is deep pessimism. The plane disappeared over the Atlantic Ocean, off the coast of Brazil, heading in the direction of Africa. Here's what else we know. Air France Flight 447 left Rio de Janeiro for Paris around 7 p.m. local time last night. There were no signs of trouble. About 4 hours later, according to Air France officials, the plane sent automatic signals indicating electrical problems and turbulence. There was no further contact. Americo dos Santos is the BBC's regional executive editor for the Americas. He joins us from London. America, what more do we know about reports of lightning strikes?
Air France is saying that that's the most likely cause of the accident. We didn't hear anything from the Brazilian officials yet. They just confirmed that they sent some military planes to search the area, but they did not speculate about what may be the cause of this accident.
Well, we did just a little research, and we're reading about a deadly lightning strike in 1963, which caused a Boeing 707 to crash. And after that, the FAA here in the States ordered that all commercial airlines be equipped with electrical discharge wicks. Now, again, this is speculation, but do we assume that this flight had that, or if it did, it might not have been enough to prevent a strike?
Yes, this is one of the mysteries surrounding this this accident, because apparently the plane had that kind of equipment. The plane had a check done on it not long ago, so it was everything seemed to be fine. Just before taking off, everything seemed to be working fine. So there is also information that the pilots always try to avoid these areas of huge storms when they can, and that didn't happen yesterday. We know that there were some storms in the area where the plane was, but we don't know exactly why this lightning would have affected this plane in this case.
One of the horrible aspects of this story is that searching for this plane is going to be so difficult. And a lot of us were surprised to find out. We have an image of people sitting in towers with their eye on every plane. But apparently there is no radar coverage in parts of the world, including where this plane was.
Yes, the Brazilian officials, they monitor, of course, the Brazilian airspace. And then at one point, apparently, these the radars in Africa start monitoring that, because obviously you are covering a huge area. The plane was already flying over the Atlantic Ocean. The last sign that we had from the plane on the radars, both military and civilian radars, was just off the coast in Brazil. And there may be areas in the South Atlantic that you don't have a good coverage of the radars. So at one point, point when they realized that the plane had disappeared, it was just after the plane had left the Brazilian coast. It was off the coast, but it's not very clear where it could have happened, and it's a huge area.
It'd be a difficult search. Well, in Paris, where the plane was supposed to land, relatives of the passengers are waiting for news there. We know you are from Brazil and have been in contact with people in Brazil, the origination. What are you hearing?
Well, there's a state of shock in parts of Rio. Apparently, the majority of the passengers were Brazilian nationals. About a third were French nationals. The families are going to the airport in search of some news. The Brazilian officials did not release any information yet, maybe because they don't have anything really to say at this point. They're taking the families to a special place in Galeão, the airport from where the plane left. I could see in the Brazilian TV and the Brazilian websites lots of images of very distressed relatives.
Yeah, understandably so. And this is the third major air crash in Brazil since 2006, so a lot of questions potentially will follow this one. Américo dos Santos, the BBC's regional executive editor for the Americas, speaking to us from London about the disappearance today of a flight from Rio to Paris, 228 passengers on board. Américo, thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
And we will be back in 30 seconds, here and now. Every Saturday morning in the Washington, D.C. Superior Court, at least six courtrooms are turned over to something called the Time Dollar Youth Court. Teens trying other teens. Now, the teen jurors make money they can apply toward buying laptops, and they judge kids like Kiara Ramirez-Girone, arrested for fighting with another girl in school.
Her two eyes were purple. She had, I think, her rib broken. I do regret the whole fight, but I don't regret exactly everything because of that, I ended up in youth court.
Like other defendants, Kiara served her sentence and now she serves on a jury. Lawyer Edgar Kahn founded the youth court in 1996. He joins us. Edgar, welcome.
Good to be with you.
And Toussaint Tingling Clemens was one of the volunteers on a youth court jury. He was never arrested. Now he's a member of the youth court staff. Toussaint, welcome to you as well.
Thank you.
And Toussaint, what kinds of cases do you see in youth court?
Most of our cases for the last year are a combination of either threats and simple assault or disorderly conduct. And most of those involve some sort of altercation within school. It's kind of sad that kids now, when there's an altercation in school, instead of the school trying to resolve it and do peer mediation, kids are being arrested.
What happens when they come before their peers? Give us an example. We know they bring their parents.
They kind of see people walking around, yellow shirts for the jurors and black shirts for the volunteers. They meet with the pre-hearing officer, and then they get a hearing of their peers.
The jury actually directly questions the defendant. The jury has the police report.
Well, how do you keep it, Toussaint, from becoming Lord of the Flies? You know, how do you keep it from being that?
Well, before any youth is allowed to be a juror, they go through training. Try to train them in restorative justice and the fact that while it may feel punitive, it's not that this process is not punitive at all, and the alternative is a lot worse. And then there's a lot of peer pressure. There's a lot of positive peer pressure.
Does it become kind of a second chance?
Right. And for me, when it really shows is when a youth is being disrespectful to their parent. If they see a respondent or someone who's having their case heard be disrespectful to their parent, the kids go off.
So the defendants then come before this jury of their peers. How does that go? Describe some of the scenes you've seen.
I've seen some very, very emotional things. They ask them to explain what happened and how it made you feel. And then the jury asks, given the same circumstance, would you reoffend? And where do you see yourself in 5 years? And how do you plan to make that a reality? It's not just to deal with why you were arrested, but hopefully this will be a life change for you.
Well, and Edgar Kahn, again, the lawyer who founded the youth court, we've been reading some of the cases that come before the youth court, and it gets very complicated very quickly. A young boy who slashes his teacher's tires, it turns out that she kept him after school. because he didn't hand in homework, and he knew that his job was to go take his little brothers and sisters home safely through gang territory, mm-hmm. and if he didn't, they might get hurt.
This was the first time anybody had ever asked him why he did it and why he was upset, because he was so scared that something would happen to his younger brother and sister. The sentence was write a letter of apology to the teacher. Second, he had to go and tell his younger brother and sister that what he did was wrong, because he had to become a role model who was able to admit that he was wrong and that that wasn't the way to deal with anger. Third, he had to pay something back for the teacher. But the other thing that he had to do, they did, was get this kid another teacher, because a teacher who doesn't understand that and couldn't let him go home to bring his own brother and sister home has no business being his teacher. They came up with a pretty complicated sentence that really understood the situation.
But can it be enacted? Can a youth court really tell a school, get this kid another teacher?
They can tell the staff, and then the staff goes to the principal, or sometimes the staff can say, let's get him into a charter school.
Well, and another part of that sentence was that this young boy was told that he had to go for a minimum of 20 hours to a boys' club. You need to be a kid and spend more time just being with your own age group. That was part of his sentence. But I guess, Toussaint, how do kids know that kids aren't playing them?
Well, you kind of hit it right on the head, is that the kids know. They walk the same streets, a lot of them. And they see each other. There are a lot of kids who remind each other and ask each other about court on Saturday. And so they know when someone is serious. I was sitting on a case. As soon as the boy walked out of the room, the kids, they look at me and say, he was lying. And they go through the entire case and poke holes in, well, you know, well, no, we all know that you don't do this. If X happens, you don't do Y, you do Z.
When Toussaint brought some of the young people to speak to the mayor's appointees who were the juvenile justice group, I still remember one young woman said, when asked, what did you learn? She said, I learned my acts have consequences. And that represents a really profound moment of growth.
Why is it more profound than going to real court?
Well, these are kids who think that they're not many who think mm-hmm. they're not going to live past 19 or 20 or 21. They don't think anything they do can alter their future. So life is about responding to anything that signifies any lack of respect or anything that where they feel that they've got to claim the moment.
And there are a lot of them who feel that the jail is almost a rite of passage.
In other words, you're saying that real court almost gives them what they expect.
I mean, if you're 23 and you haven't been to jail once or twice, then you haven't been living the correct life for a lot of them.
Edgar, you say that most kids, when they go through the real court system, assume that for at least the first three charges, nothing's going to happen to them anyway. It gets thrown out because those systems are overwhelmed.
Well, it used to be, before there was a youth court, the case was dismissed, or what they call no papered, so that they thought, well, you get three freebies before anybody takes you seriously. And what youth court does is it says, that very first time you hit the tripwire is the time we get the biggest chance. You have to deal with your peers who are telling you that's not the way to go. And second, you get enlisted as part of the jury so that you're listening to other kids who are living through often tougher times than you, often telling the same stories you thought were so unique that you made up, that there's a world that responds to you, that respects you and listens to you. But also, if the worst thing that a kid can do coming before a jury is either stonewall them or disrespect them, and then they get everything that jury can throw at them.
Well, Toussaint, as we said, you are a volunteer juror. You've never been in trouble. So did the youth court affect you?
Oh, man. I wasn't born with a silver spoon in my mouth. However, I went to a highly regarded academic high school here in the city. And so for a group of us to be sitting amongst kids who didn't have the same opportunities made a lot of us at the ages of 15 and 16 really respect and understand the opportunities that were being afforded to us. And then you also, as black men, you know, between the ages of 16 and 25, almost 80% of black men in Washington, D.C. have an arrest record.
Hmm. Did you say 80%?
Mm-hmm. Nearly 80% have some sort of arrest record.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of us, that was just a statistic, but it became real. We had a kid one time who was caught panhandling to make money for his school lunch. He was only 12. It broke everyone's heart.
And you had to try him?
Well, yeah, because he was picked up not only for panhandling, which was illegal, but he was picked up for truancy.
What sentence did you give him?
I think he was another one of those who was sentenced to community service at a Boys and Girls Club, and for his mother to get some help from different public assistance like WIC. A lot of us were petrified at the fact that he had to pay for lunch and he couldn't afford to pay for lunch.
Yeah.
Even though we dealt with almost 1,400 kids last year, all I can think about are all the other kids who we didn't get.
That's Toussaint Tingling Clemens, a former youth court juror, now a staff member at the youth court, which was founded by Edgar Kahn, a lawyer in the D.C. area. Thank you both so much for telling us about it.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you, Robin, and thank you for sharing this with a broader audience.
Well, we'd love to hear your thoughts on this or any story. You can go to hearnow.org and click on Contact Us to call or send an email, or you can leave a comment right there on the homepage. That's hearandnow.org. Back in a minute with a new take on Charles Dickens, Here and Now.
Support for Here and Now comes in part from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org.
Welcome back. 3 years before he died, the great novelist Charles Dickens began his last U.S. tour. After sending a coded message to his 20-something mistress, actress Nellie Ternan, telling her not to join him, in part because mobs of fans and curious reporters followed Dickens wherever he went as he read from his famous novels. That much is true. And now author Matthew Pearl interweaves these historical facts with page-turning fiction as book pirates and publishers race to get their hands on Dickens' unfinished last manuscript. Matthew's new novel is called The Last Dickens. The Seattle Times calls it a ripping read. And Here and Now's Lynn Menegon met with Matthew Pearl at the storied Parker House Hotel here in Boston, which was Dickens' headquarters during his 1867 tour and a place where some say Dickens' ghosts can still be seen.
Dickens would have heard the bells of the Park Street Church tolling during his stay at the Parker House, just up the street from where Revolutionary War patriots Samuel Adams, Paul Revere, and John Hancock are buried, and he knew the city well. Whenever he could escape his fans, Dickens took long walks around town. As Matthew Pearl and I stood in the hotel's Dickens room before a portrait of the somewhat weary-looking author, Pearl called Dickens a literary rock star, who arrived in the U.S. with an entourage that simply called him the chief.
He had his manager, he had a valet or dresser named Henry Scott, he even had a lighting expert named George Allison who would go to each of the events and make sure the light fell on his face just right how Dickens liked it.
And we see a Dickens here who is later in life, sort of paunchy kind of fellow with a nice beard and eyes. Now, what was the description? Eyes like exclamation points.
Right. One of the American observers named Aldrich, a Bostonian, had said that his eyes were like exclamation points, something that I always think of when I try to visualize Dickens' face. And when Dickens arrived here at the Parker House on November 19th, 1867, he was mobbed with what his manager called an ovation outside the hotel. And while he was eating supper, when he got inside, one of the waiters actually left the door to the room slightly open so people could peek in and see him. And this depressed Dickens and had an effect on him because he was very torn. On the one hand, he loved his fame. He loved adulation. On the other hand, he was a very private person with a very private side to his life.
And that scene is in your novel.
That's right. One of the things I wanted to do in The Last Dickens was to really dramatize this birth of celebrity culture. And it really marked a change in how people could relate to a famous writer in this case, but it would also apply to actors, actresses, singers. Because we were in a new age in the 19th century. We were in an age where photographs were being reproduced only recently in mass form in newspapers. We had a new type of writing, which was gossip columns. And we had this much more convenient forms of travel, which could bring someone like Dickens to another country to go on tour and to perform his books. And that really brought the celebrity into people's lives in a way that had never happened before. So in my novel, I wanted to dramatize the excitement, but also the tension that could be caused by that intersection of the public with the celebrity, and no one was more famous in Dickens' day than Charles Dickens.
And Dickens paid a price for this adulation here. There's some talk that he maybe got sick on this trip, and it led to his death.
Yeah. Toward the end of the tour, Dickens was having trouble getting up the stairs to the third floor of the Parker House, which was a sign of his health deteriorating. He was a man who never stopped. He was filled with energy, and at the same time, this was a point where his health, his strength was declining. So these were two things that were really in tension for him, and some of his friends and doctors advised him to start canceling tour appearances, and he refused to do that. In fact, he spends about 6 months in the United States. He has 76 appearances, over which time the estimate is that 114,000 Americans saw him perform live, and Dickens walked away with what is equivalent to about $150,000 profit.
That's a lot of money.
It actually constituted a third of his estate when he dies a couple years later, the money he makes from the United States. And what's interesting is, up until that point, Dickens had lost enormous sums from the United States, because here in America, our Congress had passed the copyright laws, very strange to think today, exempting foreign authors and foreign artists of any kind from being copywritten, their work. So any American publisher could and did print authors like Dickens without paying him. So in a way, he acknowledged this. This was his form of recouping some of that money he had lost.
And the world of publishing is so prominently featured in your book.
To think of publishing at this point in which there was such a cutthroat competition was really fun for me, because today we have this image of publishing as being very very staid, very old-fashioned, in contrast to sort of new media, and this was the time in our history where it was really just volatile, really combustible.
And people would literally kill for a manuscript?
Well, at least in my novel, they'll kill. But in fact, there really were sort of rogue agents of the publishing houses who would wait at the harbors in Boston and New York and Philadelphia for manuscripts to come in by ship. This is completely historical, and as well as appearing in my novel, to try to steal them. And that did happen with one of Dickens' novels in particular that we know about.
And they were called buccaneers.
That's what I call them. I didn't make up the term, actually. Buccaneers was a term used in the 19th century about pirating publishers. So I'm applying it to those agents who, as far as my research has been able to tell, weren't named and weren't recorded.
Hmm. And there's a mirror that was in his room, and this mirror still exists. Let's go take a look at that, perhaps.
Absolutely.
So we're walking down a hallway in the old Grand Hotel, big old hallways.
Yeah, it still retains some of that flavor of what it must have felt like from Dickens' descriptions. And luckily, the Parker House actually saved the mirror.
And it is huge.
Yeah, it's really a gigantic mirror, and this is where he would have stood, practices readings from The Christmas Carol, from Great Expectations, from Oliver Twist, and really get his facial expressions right. And it's said that if you look really intensely at this mirror, you can see today Charles Dickens' reflection staring out at you.
Has anybody actually reported this?
It's a legend. It's a Parker House legend. I haven't seen it yet, unless I'm Charles Dickens.
Here and Now's Lynn Menegon spoke with author Matthew Pearl at the Parker House Hotel here in Boston. Matthew's historical novel is called The Last Dickens.